And good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The guest in this first hour of the program is Robert Kagan. He is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He writes column on world affairs for The Washington Post, contributing editor at The Weekly Standard and New Republic. He's contributed articles to many publications, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, and others. He served in the State Department from 1984 until 1988 as a member of the policy planning staff, as a principal speechwriter for Secretary of State George Shultz, and as deputy for policy in the Bureau of International American Affairs. His new book that we'll be talking about here this morning is titled Dangerous Nation. The subtitle is America's Place in the World from Its Earliest Days to the Dawn of the 20th Century. It's published by Knopf, and it is the first of what is projected to be a two-volume history, this one taking a look at the period from the founding of the country to the Spanish-American War. He's joining us this morning by telephone. He is in Washington, D.C. And as we talk with Robert Kagan, questions are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. Mr. Kagan, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, thank you.
The very basic argument here, I guess we can start at the top by summarizing it, is, as I mentioned a moment ago, I think that there are a lot of Americans who see ourselves or see in America a very strong isolationist streak as a nation that has tended to be withdrawn, in a sense, inward-looking, as you describe it in the book, and being outward-directed only when forced to, particularly when attacked. Your argument is that actually that's not true fundamentally of the United States, and if you go back to the very beginnings, you can see that it's not true.
That's right, and by the very beginnings, I mean even going back to the Puritan settlement in the 17th century, we think when we look back on that period of the famous phrase of John Winthrop that we would be a city upon a hill, and certainly they meant to be an example to Europeans and hoped that they would change their religious views in accordance with the Puritan views. But at the same time, on the North American continent, Puritans initiated wars against neighboring Indian tribes, seized large quantities of land, expanded into a very fertile country, and also they were kind of revolutionaries. They didn't want to just provide an example for Europe. Ultimately, their mission was to go back to a Europe that they had revolutionized and changed fundamentally. So even the Puritans were expansionists, both religiously as well as territorially. And then if you just look at the next 200 years of American history, you see an unceasing territorial expansion, commercial expansion, as well as a kind of ideological expansion and expansion of American influence. And that's pretty much been the story ever since.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that to think about the title of the book. I think that, as I'm sure you would agree, as many reviewers would note, that now there are probably many other countries around the world that consider the United States to be a dangerous nation. But what you're jumping off from to grab onto that title is, in fact, something that John Quincy Adams said in 1817 when he was talking about the way that the rest of the world, particularly Europe, was looking at the United States and perhaps not so much thinking about what the United States was then, but thinking about what the United States could become.
Well, both, actually. I mean, I took the title from a letter that John Quincy Adams wrote to his father, as you say, in 1817. Adams was serving as the U.S. ambassador to Great Britain at the time, and he recorded to his father that all the European governments viewed the United States as a very dangerous member of the Society of Nations. Now, they certainly were looking ahead to what they assumed would be growing American power, and as Adams wrote to his father, they all hoped that the United States would split up into different pieces rather than fulfill this destiny. But even in 1817, they had already seen incredible expansiveness by the United States. The United States was aggressively taking territory from the Spanish Empire in the Floridas and in the borders with Mexico. It had already pushed France off the continent. It was already putting pressure on England during the War of 1812. Americans invaded Canada with the hope of seizing Canada. And so the United States was regarded even then as both aggressive territorially and also ideologically dangerous, because of course Europe was a continent of monarchies, and all the monarchies felt threatened by this dangerous new revolutionary ideology that the United States was spreading.
If it's interesting, I think if you look at American history and American foreign policy in this way, as you do in the book, and then you set that aside, this perception that we have about ourselves, that is, we tend to see ourselves, to think of ourselves as having this isolationist streak, whether you think that's good or bad, and then you, when you take a look at what we've done, you see, well, in fact, going back a long way, that it really hasn't been that way. Why is it, do you think, that we have this perception, this misperception about the country on this particular point?
Well, I think that's a really fascinating question, and to me the best answer is that Americans, while they have exercised power, they have sought power, they have expanded, they've taken the territory of others, they've tried to wield influence over other peoples, they've always been somewhat embarrassed about all this. There's something about the liberal ideology that we all share. There's something about the religious convictions that have long animated America, which makes us suspicious of power, including even our own power. And at the core of our national belief is the belief in individual self-determination. And so when our foreign policy, as is true of all great powers, inevitably deprives other peoples of their complete self-determination and ability to determine their own fate, I think that causes us a kind of problem. And so we suffer, I think, from a kind of cognitive dissonance and would prefer to have a view of ourselves in the past, at least, where we were more innocent. And I think in a certain sense we're always trying to recapture that imagined lost innocence. And I think it's important that we face up to what may be a more difficult reality, that we have never been that innocent power, but nevertheless we've done a great deal of good in the world despite a lack of innocence. And so I think as we look forward, we should probably be a little bit more self-aware and have a clearer sense of what we are like and how we have behaved.
Well, given one's political bent, I suppose one might be more inclined to either look at the good or the bad, or at least want to raise the question of how it is we think about the bad alongside the good. Do you see that as being part of your task in writing a book like this or exploring this history, or do you think that that's those kinds of the moral questions are for somebody else to write about, that that's really not part of the story that you're doing?
Well, I don't think anyone can address these issues without taking, you know, some account of the moral questions involved. But I really have tried in this history to take an analytical view, to try to describe what we've been like, and not to pass strong moral judgments. Because often, I think, in the desire to make moral judgments, one can wind up distorting the history. And I think that for us as Americans, we need to understand our impulses in their entirety, and not, as often is the case in American historical writing, have a history that's about good guys and bad guys. I think that's probably the biggest mistake that we make, that when American foreign policy takes a course we don't like, it's because some bad guys have taken charge of it and steered it in the wrong direction. And when we do the things we like, it's because good guys were in charge. The truth is, I think America is pretty consistent in its dealings with the world, and both the policies that we may look back fondly on and the policies that we are embarrassed about are the product of the same America. And I think that's perhaps the paradox and the complexity that I think we have to deal with.
Just very quickly, our guest is Robert Kagan. He is the author of the new book, Dangerous Nation. It takes a look at American foreign policy from the beginnings of the nation, from colonial America, really even before there was a nation, up until almost 1900. And he's planning on a second volume that will take the story the rest of the way. The book is just out now. It's published by Knopf. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk about how you think that for the first people to come here to the United States, the first Europeans to come here to settle the United States, particularly the Puritans, the people who settled in the Northeast, you seem to be making the argument that in some fundamental ways, the country that they found ended up changing them. And unless you're arguing, I'm not sure that you are, they actually came with this sort of expansionist, materialist worldview. It sounds as if you're saying that the place that they found actually ended up changing them.
Well, that's a very good question, and I think there's a little element of both in the sense that I think that if you go back to the writings of Max Weber and others, that there was something in the Protestantism that these settlers were preaching, which encouraged people to acquire wealth. It wasn't embarrassing to acquire wealth. In fact, they believed it was a sign of God's favor if you were doing well. And so there was something about the core of their religion which made them want to prosper and to think that prosperity was good. But in all other respects, certainly in the religious aspect, far from being a promised land, as they imagined it, America was really a burial ground for the very strict Puritan view, the Calvinist view of how religion should be practiced, because there was so much land available. There were so many opportunities for people to leave a city. The fathers of the Puritan fathers wanted to have complete control over everybody, but if someone didn't like the way they were preaching in Massachusetts, they could head up the Connecticut Valley and preach differently. So that immediately led to schisms. Moreover, if you read the sort of the Jeremiads of the early Puritans, they were complaining that all anybody seemed to want was land, and that land, the desire for land, was turning them away from the theological project that the Puritans were supposed to be there for. And so, yes, I mean, the American wilderness, in a sense, undid the Puritan mission, really, in a matter of a generation or two. And meanwhile, in the rest of the North America settled by the Anglo-Americans, there had never been that Puritan idea, and in most of it was about getting land, getting wealth, making a new start, and pretty quickly those two blended into each other and became a dominant American ethos of getting ahead, making a good living, having independence, finding new land, and that was really what made America the America that we know it today.
Yeah, I think you make an interesting and kind of novel argument that at least at the beginning here, rather than the Americans, the what would be Americans seeing themselves as a movement that was, in a sense, anti-expansionist, anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist. It was sort of the opposite of everything of the place that they came from, that at least at the beginning, they saw themselves as part of that same project.
Well, that's certainly true by the time of the middle of the 18th century before the Revolution. If you look at someone like, for instance, George Washington, George Washington's great aspiration was to be a soldier in the British Imperial Army. He considered himself British, and he saw the British Imperial mission as the expansion of British territory on the North American continent. Or look at someone like Benjamin Franklin. He may be one of the greatest imperialists in the history of the United States, because he argued very strongly that the British Empire should expand quickly and even preemptively and take the Ohio Valley from France before France was able to grow too strong, and then to take Canada. And so you see in Franklin, in Jefferson, in Washington, in Madison, real strong territorial expansionism right from before even the Revolution, and they continued that expansionism after the Revolution for the next 40 years.
Was there then, though, an inevitability about the American Revolution? Could these people that we're talking about here have achieved what they wanted and remain part of the British Empire?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think the answer depends on whether the British Empire could have pursued a different policy. But I think, by and large, it was inevitable. Once you had this very aggressive, prosperous, successful, and large population on the North American continent, it was going to be very difficult for the authorities back in London to control. And indeed, one of the issues that produced so much dissatisfaction in the colonies and led and helped produce ultimately the revolution was when Britain, having signed various treaties with France, mostly to solve problems that existed in Europe, in those treaties tried to prevent the colonists from expanding even farther west against French interests. And the colonists chafed under those restrictions and very much looked forward to, after the revolution, moving ahead and expanding into those territories which the British Empire had prevented them from expanding. And so I do think it was inevitable, and much of what drove the revolution was not only a territorial expansionism, but also a commercial expansionism, and also, increasingly, an ideological expansionism.
And maybe we just layer one more thing on that. They did indeed have genuine security concerns, and so part of expansionism has to do with that as well, pushing out your borders further, as in a sense, as a way of defending them.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, there is what the theorists call defensive expansion, and there's a famous quotation that Catherine the Great of Russia said, "I have no way of defending my borders except to expand them." But I think it certainly would be a mistake to view American expansion in this period as purely defensive or even largely defensive. It's true that every time they expanded, there were hostile tribes or empires just across the border, but a lot of this expansion was driven by simple desire for land. You can call it greed, or you can call it a desire for independence, because acquiring property in that time meant independence, it meant freedom. And so there was both the push of the desire for acquiring new land, as well as the defensive response to those who wanted to prevent the expansion. But it certainly wasn't purely defensive.
Let me introduce again our guest for this first hour of Focus 580, Robert Kagan. He's Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a Transatlantic Fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He's also a columnist for the Washington Post. He's authored several books and is now talking with us about his most recent. It is titled Dangerous Nation. The subtitle is America's Place in the World from Its Earliest Days to the Dawn of the 20th Century. And it's the first of what will be two volumes. So this is from the beginning to the Spanish-American War. Then the second volume will take us from essentially to 1900 to the present. The book is out now. It's published by Knopf. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe we might talk just a little bit about, talk about foreign policy, American foreign policy, around the time of the revolution, but particularly, say, in the couple of decades right after the revolution, and what American foreign policy was, and in what sense that that underlines or exemplifies the argument that you're making.
Well, I mean, the first thing to be said about America after the revolution is that it was an extremely weak nation. In fact, it was a very strong nation when it was part of the British Empire. And so when the revolution occurred and the United States separated itself from Britain, it lost a great, powerful imperial patron and gained a great, powerful imperial enemy. And so from the very beginning after the revolution, the United States had to deal with the fact that the British were sort of hostile. And then soon after the ratifying of the Constitution, you have the French Revolution. And the conflict between France and Britain dominates the discussion of foreign policy in the first decade of the United States and the Young Republic. And what was interesting there was that almost everyone in America supported the French Revolution initially, which is a sign of just how strongly the ideological aspect of American foreign policy always has been. Whether people were on George Washington's side or Alexander Hamilton's side, or, of course, Thomas Jefferson, who was the great enthusiast for the French Revolution, they all looked for the success of the French Revolution because they saw it as, in part, and justifiably so, growing out of their own revolution, and they saw it as a kind of vindication of the idea of individual rights and universal rights that was part of their Declaration of Independence. The problem came when the French Revolution took a very bad turn and turned into a kind of authoritarian dictatorship and then an expansionist power on the continent of Europe, and Americans had to decide what their posture was going to be between Britain and France. But throughout all this, ideological principles rather than what some people would refer to as sort of pure calculations of realpolitik were dominant. At the same time as all that was happening in Europe, however, the United States was in continuing on its very strong expansionist course on the North American continent and even into the commercial markets of the Mediterranean and East Asia. The United States began pressuring for more territory in the South and in the West, culminating ultimately in a treaty with Spain in 1819 that deprived Spain of almost all its holdings on the North American continent. France was pushed off, Russia was ultimately pushed off, and so that is a period of enormous growth of the United States, enormous growth in power and even global influence, which is one of the reasons why Europe in 1817, as John Quincy Adams observed, had already determined that the United States was a dangerous nation.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And we'll start here with someone in Champaign County on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wonder how you talk about the, let's say, Mark Twain and the Anti-Imperialist League and the fact that Abraham Lincoln, when he was in the House of Representatives, voted against the Mexican War. I think that we sort of have this lost history, I don't know if you're recuperating it or not, of opposition to empire that was ongoing and thorough and still exists to this day. It's marginalized, of course, and but I just wonder in your historical frame how you treat that kind of opposition. You just say it's always been marginal. It got opposition to the war. World War One was actually fairly substantive. In this country, some millions of people voted for Eugene Debs when he was still in prison. So I'll listen to what I expect to hear here.
All right. Well, Mr. Kagan?
Well, it's a very good point, and I can assure the caller that I deal in great detail with the opposition to all the conflicts that the United States engaged in, going back to the Revolution, of course, which was opposed by a substantial number of Americans who didn't want to go to war against Great Britain. The War of 1812 almost led to the secession of the New England states. I think Connecticut even voted to secede. Abraham Lincoln's opposition to the Mexican-American War is a very interesting study because what he was opposing and what everyone who opposed that war, most of whom were Northerners, were opposing was the expansion of slavery. They considered the Mexican War to be a slaveholder's plot to gain control of Mexican territory where slavery could be implanted. And indeed, that was very much what that war was about. And so for people like Lincoln, John Quincy Adams, who was one of the great expansionists of all time, no one is probably responsible for acquiring more territory, sometimes through war, than John Quincy Adams, but he opposed that expansion because it was going to be slave expansion. And one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is the influence and debate over slavery and how that influenced American foreign policy. If you go back to the late 19th century, which the caller talked about, it's a very interesting period because people like Mark Twain and a lot of the people who later became anti-imperialists were great and enthusiastic supporters of the American war against Spain with the goal of liberating Cuba, as they saw it. Everyone from William Jennings Bryan on one side to Henry Cabot Lodge on the other, even Andrew Carnegie, who became the leading anti-imperialist, supported the war against Spain in 1898. Where they parted company was when the McKinley administration decided after the United States attacked Spanish position in Philippines, that the United States had an obligation to take control of the Philippines for a variety of reasons, which were either good or bad. But it was that produced the great anti-imperialist movement. Americans have been debating this issue since the very beginning, since the day when Patrick Henry denounced the Constitution itself because he accused George Washington and others of wanting a great and mighty empire. And so there has been a constant debate for a variety of reasons throughout our history. And the only thing that is worth, what's interesting about that debate is that generally those arguing for a larger and more expansive foreign policy have won. And I think that has to do with the essential character of the nation and its liberal expansive qualities. But there's no question that we have been in also in a constant debate about these things.
So you're saying that the opposition to the Spanish-American War and the conquest of was sort of a manifest destiny, that it was our empire that it should extend to Cuba. Jefferson's notably quote saying that Cuba was like a ripe fruit and will drop into our hands. But I would say that there's still an opening for idealists to say that we would have wanted to decolonize Cuba so that, you know, democracy might flourish. Now, obviously, that's a ruse that's being used even in this imperial age.
I have to disagree with your
interpretation
of why we went into the Spanish-American War in the first place. I mean, there was certainly the usual selfish motives. There was some commercial interest. There was also a desire to drive Spain out of the hemisphere and become the dominant power in the hemisphere, which was a goal that did go back to Jefferson and Hamilton. But I would say that the overriding aim in the Spanish-American War, again, rightly or wrongly, was humanitarian. And I think we have forgotten what was going on in Cuba during that time. There was a horrendous policy of near genocide that resulted in the deaths of something like 300,000 Cuban people, which was about one-fifth of the overall population, that Americans, including progressives, including humanitarians, including pacifists in many cases, believed was just too horrendous to stand by and do nothing. And it's very important to understand, and again, this may be an irony that is relevant to our times today, that we went into Cuba precisely for the purpose of liberating Cuba from this very nasty Spanish domination, but then wound up getting bogged down in an occupation of Cuba that did not turn out as we had hoped and expected, and also getting ourselves into a nasty war in the Philippines. And so it's only yet another indication that, you know, you want to look for bad motives, but often it is the good motives that can get us into trouble. And I think that's a more profound lesson from American history. It's not that there are bad imperialists out there trying to become an empire. It's often that there are people who want to alleviate suffering, but use power to do so, and sometimes with unintended consequences. Mm.
I hope the caller will forgive me. I got two other people here and only about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to move on. But there's also one thing I'd like to have you talk for a moment or two about, which is an important subject you spent a lot of time with in the book, and you've touched on it, and that is the connection between slavery and the debate over slavery and U.S. foreign policy. And I suppose some people might say on the face of it, they might say, well, what exactly do those two things have to do with each other?
Well, I mean, I must say it was one of the most dramatic surprises, not that I didn't know it existed, but as I did the research for this book, that the role of slavery in American foreign policy was much greater than I realized. And, you know, I think once you realize, once you think about it, it really is, it makes a lot of sense. The United States, when it was born, was not only a democratic republic, it was also a slave dictatorship. And much of American foreign policy, from the Constitution onwards until the Civil War, was dedicated to protecting slavery from both domestic pressures and from foreign pressures. The slaveholders' national interest, and the slaveholders had a dominant influence on American domestic as well as foreign policy throughout those eight decades. Their number one interest was to hold on to their investment in terms of slavery, and also to prevent what they feared more than anything else, which was a slave uprising. Nothing concentrated the Southern slaveholders' mind more than the fear that their slaves would rebel against them and kill them. And they saw an example of this in Haiti in the late 18th century, when the slaves rose up and killed their masters and took over. Most of the South spent the next 80 years in dreadful fear that there would be another Haiti. And so America was about, in these period, defending slavery and using their foreign policy tools to do it until the North and the South conflict became the dominant factor in American life, roughly in the 1830s and 1840s, at which point you really had two foreign policies. You had a northern foreign policy seeking to eradicate slavery, and you had a southern foreign policy seeking to preserve it. They were completely at odds with each other, and it wasn't until the Civil War that this whole issue was mostly reconciled, because, of course, even then you had a very unsuccessful Reconstruction. But that issue was a dominant factor in American foreign policy throughout that period.
All right, let's talk with some other callers. Champagne is next, line two. Hello.
Yes, I'm glad you spoke to this issue of slavery and its connection with foreign policy, and by implication, of course, as well, capitalism as it developed in the States and certain financial interests. I'm also, though, interested, as I think the previous caller was, in this question of from when was it and in what way was it that the leaders had to provide real justification for a kind of expansionist foreign policy, that there certainly were people who, as with Lincoln in the Mexican-American War, called into question what the president's intentions in his behavior. In Polk's case, of course, Lincoln, put forth the Spot Amendments and so on. And the stated reason, of course, technically was not slavery, but, of course, that he lied, right? He lied in order to attack Mexico using a fictional killing of an American by a Mexican on American soil. And so I'm wondering, although there is that early example of really calling into question the president's intentions and his need to provide justification to the Congress and others, I'm just wondering, is there a real difference now in, for example, the post-World War II period with the Geneva Conventions, with this whole series of new treaties and so on with other nations, in the development of international law, whether things have changed in any real way? Can we call the president to task to justify a war of presumed aggression? And is, of course, in terms of American history, a war of aggression may be the rule, but does that is there any check on that at this point in our history?
Well, it's an interesting question. I guess I do want to emphasize, based on what this caller is saying and what the last caller was also getting at, I don't want anybody to be under the mistaken impression that Lincoln was anti-expansionist.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great expansionist, but he believed in the expansion of free territory, not in the expansion of slave territory. The Northern Republican Party position in the period of the Civil War and after the Civil War was that the United States should expand its territory, and not only its territory, but also its reach into East Asia, into the Western Hemisphere. So what Lincoln and his colleagues opposed, as I said, was slave expansion, but they were perfectly happy to expand the nation in if there was not going to be slavery. Now, as to, you know, calling presidents to account, I don't think there's been a single war where opponents of the war haven't accused the president of lying. We all recall that the Republican position with regard to FDR and the Second World War was that he tricked Americans into war. And I know that there were Republicans for decades after World War II who believed that that Roosevelt knew that the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming, and he deceived the Americans in order to get them into war. There were many who felt betrayed by Woodrow Wilson, who had promised not to get the United States into a war, and then did get America into the First World War. Certainly the Spanish-American War was fraught with controversy. I don't think there's ever been a war in America that hasn't been filled with controversy. In some cases, the presidents may have been deceptive. In other cases, I don't think they were deceptive, but opponents of the war accused them of that deception. I mean, the idea that, but I guess I question the idea that presidents are somehow out of control. You would have to suggest that somehow the fundamental structure of the American system doesn't work, but the premise of that is that the American people don't support these wars, only presidents do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the evidence supports that at all. As I say, certainly the Spanish-American War was a wildly popular war, and certainly other wars that we've fought have been very popular, and I don't think simply because the people were deceived, I think it was because the American people, although they don't like to admit it, are willing to use force, are ambitious, and are willing to go to war for causes that are both idealistic and also selfish. And I just think that's a reality we need to confront rather than constantly search for conspiracies to explain this behavior.
No, I agree with you on that. I just wonder about, of course, the non-use of the declaration of war over the past almost 60 years.
Well, you might say over the past 220 years, right? I mean, Thomas Jefferson and other presidents conducted on and off warfare in the Mediterranean for more than a decade without a declaration of war, and there are many other similar examples of that, and that is, you know, the exercise of presidential power. Since the need to declare war is a disputed point, of course, in constitutional theory.
I want to thank the caller and go on to someone else. This is Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Good morning. In the discussion of expansion on North America, were there any opposition at all to wars with Native American? Because I'm, in my own opinion, I think the driving force of manifest destiny runs through those types of wars, and also in the Mexican War, in which one author has pointed out that President Polk adopted the territorial claims of Texas after it was admitted, and as you said, also he was a slaveholder himself, and had no qualms about bringing slavery into new territory conquered from Mexico. Any comments on that?
Well, I mean, I take your question to be whether there was a great deal of opposition to the wars with expansion against the Indian population.
Yeah, especially the Creek Wars, which drove them out of the southern states, across southern Illinois.
I mean, conflicts that right after the birth of the nation, there were always opponents saying that the Indians were being badly treated, and in fact they were, of course, not only because they were being exterminated, but because we kept signing treaties with them, which we kept breaking. And there was a great deal of concern in the Washington administration. If you go back and look at Secretary of War Knox, he really thought that this behavior, in addition to whatever effect it was having on the Indians, was a stain on the nation's reputation, and wondered how the United States could stand up as a great liberal democratic nation while it was lying and cheating and killing.
Well, they did it consistently, though. We had our own nasty little episode called the Black Hawk War here in Illinois.
And so let me just go on, which is that despite these misgivings, there was never the smallest effort really to stop this overall aggressive policy. In the East, it was a lot easier to say we don't need all that territory, leave the Indians alone. But the people of the West, who wanted the territory, who felt threatened by the Indians, were the dominant political force. I mean, settlers were voters. People who wanted Indian land were voters. And ultimately, the East, whatever misgivings there were in the East, couldn't override that power. So, no, there was not. Certainly not sufficient opposition to make any meaningful difference.
Thank you.
All right, and Chicago is another caller here, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. To take a step forward, about a week ago on the Terry Gross Fresh Air program, James Baker was a guest, and he said it's become part of our foreign policy now to state that we will go to war in order to maintain access for oil. And I didn't know that we had this as an integral part of our foreign policy, with also the premise that we would topple the reigning regime, Saddam Hussein.
James Baker actually said that?
He said that on the Terry Gross Show a week ago, a Fresh Air program about a week ago.
Well, I mean, having not heard what Mr. Baker said, I don't know, you know, I'm a little reluctant to comment on it.
Yeah, well, I thought maybe you had known that.
No, I didn't know that. But, I mean, you know, look, whether we have a stated policy of protecting the oil supply or not, and in fact, I think we actually did articulate a stated policy that we considered it of strategic importance to us to protect the oil supply. And guess who the president who did that was? Jimmy Carter. If you recall, way back when, there was something called the Carter Doctrine, which was about, America assuming the right to to protect it, among other things, assuming the right to protect its oil supply. So as I say, whether it was a stated policy or not, surely that has been an American policy for some time. I don't think there's anything surprising about that. However, I strongly reject the assertion that that was the reason we went to war against Saddam Hussein, for the simple reason that if we wanted Saddam Hussein's oil, all we had to do was normalize relations with Saddam Hussein. He was delighted to sell us his oil. He was delighted to invite American oil companies in to find the oil. And if we wanted oil, there was a much cheaper way to get it. So, America has always wanted to have access to strategic supplies, of one kind or another. But, I don't think that's the reason we went to war in Iraq.
We're to the point here where we have maybe a minute or two left, and we have sketched out what is probably a more complicated and more detailed kind of argument. So people, if you want to read more on this, you can look at the book that we have talked about. Just as a way of finishing up, I guess I'm wondering now, you're working on, there will be another book, so we'll cover the complete, relatively speaking, a complete history of the United States. Whether over time, particularly in the 20th century, that the United States, given its experience, have governments ever really thought any differently, particularly about this idea of manifest destiny, expansionism, and how it is that we want to bring it to other countries the benefits of our way of doing things. And it just seems that we have stumbled as many times as we've been successful, but that somehow every time we try to do that, we seem not to be inclined to look back on our past experience.
Well, I hate to prejudge a period that I haven't done the kind of thorough research that I've done for the past, but so let me just put in that caveat. But otherwise, I would say I generally agree with what you're saying. But certainly, if you just look, I could just give you a couple of examples. After the end of the Second World War, Dean Acheson, and you can see this, by the way, in a fine biography of Acheson that's new by Robert Beisner, referred to the United States as the locomotive of mankind, and the rest of the world is the caboose. And so the idea that the United States was central to global progress, was central to international security, was central, and not only was it central in theory, but in terms of its ability to have and use both military and economic power to do this. And 50 years later, a president as different as Bill Clinton was referring to the United States as the world's indispensable nation. And so I would say we have had this sense of ourselves all the way through. People treat our rise to the global dominance as if it was some kind of accident. I don't think you can look at our whole history and suggest that it is an accident. It's what the founding fathers expected. It's what presidents and secretaries of state and politicians have been calling for from the 19th century onward. And here today, we still think of ourselves as the indispensable nation. And this does create all kinds of problems and lead to mistakes, and it also produces some enormous successes, like the defeat of Japanese imperialism and Nazi Germany, the defeat of the Soviet Union. We would like to only do good things and only get it right all the time, but on the other hand, we are also human. And I think in some respects, the things that make us great are also the same things that often get us into trouble.
All right. Well, there we must leave it. If people would like to read more, the book is Dangerous Nation, America's Place in the World from Its Earliest Days to the Dawn of the 20th Century, by Robert Kagan. The book is published by Knopf. Book is new. It's out now in the bookstores. You can certainly can find it there. Our guest, Robert Kagan, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Transatlantic Fellow with the German Marshall Fund, columnist for the Washington Post, author of a number of other books. And he's joining us this morning by phone from Washington, D.C. Mr. Kagan, thank you.
Well, thank you.